what you're thinking. Freeman nodded. Fair enough. I did make the call, after all. Are we in agreement that this is off the record? Nothing leaves this room if no agreement is eventually struck. Sure. Aronson nodded along with me. Okay, then. This is what we are thinking. And this already has approval from on high. We drop down to man and recommend the mid-level. I nodded, projecting my lower lip in a manner that suggested that it was an offer with merit. But I knew that if she opened with manslaughter with a mid-range sentence recommendation, it could only get better for my client. I also knew that my instincts were right. There was no way the DA would float an offer like this unless something was seriously wrong. By my estimation, the case was weak from the moment they put the cuffs on my client. But now, something had fallen out of place. Something big, and I had to find out what that was. That's a good offer, I said. You're damn right. We're coming down off premeditated and lying in wait. I'm assuming we're talking voluntary manslaughter. It would be hard even for you to make a case for involuntary. It's not like she just happened to be in that garage. Do you think she'll take it? I don't know. She said since the start, no deals. She wants a trial. I can try to sell it. It's just that... Just that what? I'm curious, you know. Why such a nice offer? Why are you coming down to this? What's gone wrong inside your case that makes you feel you need to cut and run? This is not cutting and running. She'll still go to prison and there will still be justice. There's nothing wrong with our case, but trials are expensive and long. Across the board, the DA's office is trying for dispositions over trials. But dispositions that make sense. This is one of those times. You don't want it. I'm ready to go. I held my hands up in surrender. I could see her focus on the plaster cast on my left hand. It's not whether I want it. It's my client's choice, and I have to give her all the information I can. That's all. I've been in this position before. Usually a deal this good is too good to be true. You take it, and you end up finding out later that the main witness was going to flake out, or the prosecution just picked up a nice piece of exculpatory evidence you would have gotten in discovery if you'd hung on just a little bit longer. Yeah, well, not this time. It is what it is. You have 24 hours, and then it comes off the table. What about going with the low range? What? It was almost a shriek. Come on, you didn't come in here and give me your last best offer. No one works that way. You have one more give and we both know it. Voluntary manslaughter, low-range sentencing recommendation. She'll do 5 to 7 tops. You're killing me. The press will eat me alive. Maybe, but I know your boss didn't send you over here with one offer, Andrea. She leaned back and looked at Aronson and then around the rest of the room, her eyes trailing over the shelves of books that came with the office. I waited. I glanced at Aronson and winked. I knew what was coming. I'm sorry about your hand, Freeman said. That must have hurt. Actually, it didn't. I was already down for the count when they did it. I never felt a thing. I held up my hand again and wiggled my fingers, their tips moving along the top edge of the cast. I can already move them pretty good. Okay, low range. I still need to hear back in 24 hours, and this is all off the record. Other than to your client, this is not to be revealed outside of this room if it doesn't go. We already agreed to that. Okay, then I guess that's it. I'll be heading back. She stood up and Aronson and I followed. We dropped into the sort of small talk that often follows a meeting of great importance. So, who's going to be the next DA? I asked. Your guess is as good as mine, Freeman said. There's no front runner yet, that's for sure. The office was currently operating with an interim district attorney, following the appointment of its former holder to a top job in the U.S. Attorney General's office in Washington, D.C. A special election would be held in the fall to fill the slot, and so far the field of candidates was uninspiring. Finished with the pleasantries, we shook hands, and Freeman left the office. Sitting back down, I looked at Aronson. So what do you think?
I think you're right. The offer was too good, and then she made it even better.
Something's gone wrong in her case. Yeah, but what? We can't exploit it if we don't know what it is. I leaned forward to the phone and pushed the intercom. I told Cisco to come in. I swiveled in silence while we waited. Cisco entered, put my cell phone down on the desk, and then took the seat where Freeman had sat. I have the trace underway. I'd give it 3 days. They don't move that quickly. Thanks. So what's up with the prosecutor? She's running scared, and we don't know why. I know you're vetted against everything she's given us and checked out the witnesses. I want to do it again. Something's changed. Something they thought they had, they no longer have. We have to find out what it is. Margot Schaefer, probably. How so? Cisco shrugged. Just speaking from experience. Eyewitnesses are unreliable. Schaefer is a big part of a very circumstantial case. They lose her, or she turns up shaky, and they have a big problem. We already know it's going to be tough to convince a jury that she saw what she claims she saw. But we still haven't talked to her? She refused to be interviewed, and is under no obligation to do so. I opened the middle drawer of the desk and pulled out a pencil. I pushed its point into the top opening of the cast, and down between two fingers, then maneuvered the pencil back and forth to scratch my palm. "What are you doing?" Cisco asked. "What's it look like? Itching my palm. It was driving me crazy the whole meeting."
"You know what they say about itchy palms," Aronson said.
I looked at her, wondering if there was some sort of sexual innuendo to the answer. "No, what?"
"If it's your right hand, you're going to come into money. If it's your left, then you are going to pay out money. If you scratch them, you stop it from happening."
"They teach you that in law school, Bullocks?"
"No, my mother always said it. She was superstitious. She thought it was true."
"Well, if it is, I just saved us a bunch of money." I pulled the pencil out and put it back in the drawer. "Cisco, take another run at Schaefer. Try to catch her off guard. Show up somewhere she'd never expect it. See how she reacts. See if she talks." "You got it." "If she doesn't talk, take another run at her background. Maybe there's a connection we don't know about." "If there is, I'll find it. That's what I'm counting on." Chapter 16. As I had expected, Lisa Trammell wanted no part in a plea agreement that would put her in prison for as long as 7 years, even though she faced the possibility of 4 times that amount if convicted at trial. She chose to take her chances on an acquittal, and I couldn't blame her. While I remained at a loss to explain the state's change of heart, the offer of a defense-friendly disposition made me think the prosecution was running scared, and that we had a legitimate fighting chance. If my client was willing to roll the dice, then so was I. It wasn't my freedom at stake. I was cruising home at the end of work the next day when I called Andrea Freeman to give her the news. She had left several messages early in the day, and I had strategically not returned them, hoping to make her sweat. It turned out she was anything but feeling the heat. When I told her my client was passing on the offer, she simply laughed.
Holler, you might want to start returning your messages a little sooner. I tried several times this morning to get to you. That offer was permanently taken off the table at 10 o'clock. She should have accepted it last night, and it probably would have saved her about 20 years in prison.
Who pulled the offer? Your boss?
I did. I changed my mind, and that's that.
I couldn't think of what could have caused such a dramatic change in less than 24 hours. The only activity on the case that morning that I knew of was Louis Aparicio's attorney filing a motion to quash the subpoena we had served on him. But I didn't see the connection to Freeman's abrupt change in direction on the plea. When I didn't respond, Freeman moved to end the call.
So, counselor, I guess I'll see you in court.
Yeah, and just so you know, I'm going to find it, Andrea.
Find what?
Whatever it is you're hiding. The thing that went wrong yesterday, that made you bring me that offer. Doesn't matter if you think it's all fixed now, I'm going to find it, and when we get to trial, I'll have it in my back pocket. She laughed into the phone, in a way that immediately undercut the confidence I'd had in my statement.
Like I said, I'll see you in court.
she said. Yeah, I'll be there, I said. I put the phone down on the armrest and tried to intuit what was going on. Then it struck me I might already be carrying Freeman's secret in my back pocket. The letter from Bondurant to Aparicio had been hidden in the haystack of documents Freeman had turned over. Maybe she had found it only recently herself and realized what I could do with it, how I could build a defense case around it. It happens sometimes. A prosecutor gets a case with what seems like overwhelming evidence, and hubris sets in. You go with what you've got, and other potential evidence goes undiscovered until late, sometimes too late. I became convinced. It had to be the letter. A day ago, she was running scared because of the letter. Now, she was confident. Why? The only difference between yesterday and today was the motion to quash the Aparicio subpoena. All at once, I understood her strategy. The prosecution would support the dismissal of the subpoena. If Aparicio didn't testify, I might not be able to get the letter before the jury. If I had it right, then there could be a severe setback for the defense at the hearing on the motion. I now knew I had to be prepared to fight as though my case depended on it, because it did. I decided to put the phone in my pocket. No more calls. It was Friday evening. I would put the case aside and take it all up again in the morning. Everything could wait until then. Rojas, put on some music. It's the weekend, man. Rojas hit the button on the dash to play the CD. I had forgotten what I had in there, but soon identified the song as Ry Cooder singing Teardrops Will Fall, a cover of the 1960s classic on his anthology disc. It sounded good, and it sounded right. A song about lost love and being left alone. The trial would start in less than 3 weeks. Whether or not we figured out what Freeman was hiding, the defense team was locked and loaded and ready to go. We still had some outstanding subpoenas to serve, but otherwise we were fit for battle, and I was growing more confident every day. The following Monday, I would hole up in my office and start choreographing the defense case. The hypothesis of innocence would be carefully revealed piece by piece and witness by witness, until it all came together in a crushing wave of reasonable doubt. But I still had a weekend to fill before that, and I wanted to put as much distance as I could between me and Lisa Trammell and everything else. Cooter was now on to Poor Man's Shangri-La, the one about the UFOs and space vatos in Chavez Ravine, before they took it away from the people and put up Dodger Stadium. I told Rojas to turn it up. I lowered the back windows and let the wind and music blow through my hair and ears. I closed my eyes as we cruised. Chapter 17. Rojas dropped me at the steps of my home, and I slowly made my way up while he put the Lincoln in the garage. His own car was parked on the street. He'd take it home and come back Monday, the usual routine. Before opening the door, I stepped to the far end of the deck and looked out at the city. The sun still had a couple of hours of work ahead, then would set on another week. From up here, the city had a certain sound that was as identifiable as a train whistle, the low hiss of a million dreams in competition. You all right? I turned around. It was Rojas at the top of the steps. Yeah, fine. What's the matter?
I don't know. I saw you standing up here and thought maybe something was wrong, like you were locked out or something.
No, I was just checking out the city. I came over to the door, pulling out my house key. Have a good weekend, Rojas.
You too, boss.
You know, you should probably stop calling me boss.
Okay, boss.
Whatever. I turned the lock and pushed the door open. I was immediately greeted with a sharp and multi-voiced cheer of surprise. I once got shot in the gut after opening the same door. This surprise was a lot better. My daughter rushed forward and hugged me, and I hugged her back. I looked around the room and saw everybody. Cisco, Lorna, Bullocks, my half-brother Harry Bosch and his daughter Maddie. And Maggie was there, too. She came up next to Haley and kissed me on the cheek.
I said. I've got some bad news. Today is not my birthday. I'm afraid you've all been led astray by someone with some sort of devious plan to get cake.
Maggie punched me on the shoulder. Your birthday's Monday, not a good day for a surprise party.
Yeah, exactly as I planned it.
Come on, get out of the door and let Rojas in. Nobody's staying that long. We just wanted to say happy birthday.
I leaned forward and kissed her cheek and whispered in her ear. What about you? You're not staying long either?
We'll see about that.
She escorted me in through a gauntlet of handshakes, kisses, and backpats. It was nice and totally unexpected. I was placed in the seat of honor and handed a lemonade. The party lasted another hour, and I got time to visit with all my guests. I hadn't seen Harry Bosch in a few months. I had heard he'd come by the hospital, but I wasn't awake for the visit. We had worked on a case the year before with me as a special prosecutor. It had been nice being on the same side, and I had thought the experience would keep us close. But it hadn't really worked out that way. Bosch remained as distant as ever, and I remained as saddened about it as ever. When I saw the opportunity, I moved toward him, and we stood side by side in front of the window that gave the best view of the city. From this angle, it's hard not to love it, isn't it? He asked. I turned from the view to him, and then back. He was drinking a lemonade, too. He had told me he'd stopped drinking when his teenage daughter had come to live with him. I know what you mean, I said. He drained his glass and thanked me for the party. I told him he could leave Maddie with us if she wanted to visit Haley longer. But he said that he already had plans to take her to a shooting range in the morning. A shooting range? You're taking your daughter to a shooting range? I've got guns in the house. She should know how to use them. I shrugged. I guessed there was a logic in it. Bosch and his daughter were the first to leave, and soon afterward, the party ended. Everybody left except for Maggie and Haley. They had decided to stay the night. Exhausted by the day and the week and the month, I took a long shower and then got into bed early. Soon, Maggie came in, after talking Haley to sleep in her room. She closed the door, and that was when I knew my real birthday present was coming. She hadn't brought any nightclothes with her. Lying on my back, I watched her get undressed and then slip under the covers with me.
You know, you're a piece of work, Holler, she whispered.
What did I do this time?
You just trespassed all over the place.
She moved in close and then over on top of me. She bent down, tenting my face with her hair. She kissed me and started slowly moving her hips. Then put her lips against my ear.
So, she said, normal function and activity. That's what the doctor told you, right?
That's what he said.
We'll see.
Part 3. Bolero. Chapter 18. Louis Aparicio was a man who did not want to be served. As an attorney, he knew that the only way he could be dragged into the Lisa Trammell trial was to be served with a subpoena to testify. Avoiding service meant avoiding testimony. Whether he had been tipped to the defense strategy or simply was smart enough to understand it on his own, he seemingly disappeared just at the time we began looking for him. His whereabouts became unknown, and all the routine tricks of the trade to track him and draw him out had failed. We did not know if Aparicio was in the country, let alone in Los Angeles. Aparicio had one very big thing going for him in his effort to hide. Money. With enough money, you can hide from anybody in this world, and Aparicio knew it. He owned numerous homes in numerous states, multiple vehicles, and even a private jet to help him connect quickly to all his dots. When he moved, whether it was from state to state or from Beverly Hills home to Beverly Hills office, he traveled behind a phalanx of security men. He also had one thing going against him, money. The vast wealth he had accumulated by carrying out the bidding of banks and other lenders had also given him an Achilles heel. He had acquired the tastes and desires of the super rich. And that was how we eventually got him. In the course of his efforts to locate Aparicio,
Cisco Wojciechowski amassed a tremendous amount of information about his quarry's profile. From this data, a trap was carefully planned and executed to perfection. A glossy presentation package announcing the closed bid auction of an Aldo Tinto painting was sent to Aparicio's office in Beverly Hills. The package said the painting would be on view for interested bidders for only 2 hours, beginning at 7 p.m. two nights hence, in Studio Z at Bergamot Station in Santa Monica. Bids would then be accepted until midnight. The presentation looked professional and legitimate. The depiction of the painting had been lifted from an online art catalog that displayed private collections. We knew from a 2-year-old profile of Aparicio in a bar journal that he had become a collector of second-tier painters and that the late Italian master Tinto was his obsession. When a man called the phone number on the portfolio, identified himself as a representative of Louis Aparicio, and booked a private viewing of the painting, we had him. The Aparicio entourage entered the old red car trolley station, which had been turned into an upscale gallery complex, at precisely the appointed time. While 3 sunglassed security men fanned out across the grounds, 2 more swept Gallery Z before giving the all-clear signal. Only then did Aparicio emerge from the stretch Mercedes. Inside the gallery, Aparicio was met by 2 women who disarmed him with their smiles and excitement about the arts and the painting he was about to see. One woman handed him a glass flute of Cristal to celebrate the moment. The other gave him a thick folded packet of documents on the painting's pedigree and exhibition history. Because he held the champagne in one hand, he could not open the documents. He was told he could read it all later because he must see the painting now before the next appointment. He was led into the viewing room where the piece sat on an ornate easel covered with a satin drape. A lone spotlight lit the center of the room. The women told him he could remove the drape himself, and one of them took his glass of champagne. She wore long gloves. Aparicio stepped forward, his hand raised in anticipation. He carefully pulled the satin off the frame. And there, pinned to the board, was the subpoena. Confused, he leaned forward to look, perhaps thinking this was still the Italian master's work. "You've been served, Mr. Aparicio," Jennifer Aronson said. "You have the original in your hand." "I don't understand," he said, but he did. "And the whole thing from the moment you drove in is on videotape," said Lorna. She stepped to the wall and hit the switch, bathing the entire room in light. She pointed to the 2 overhead cameras. Jennifer lifted the champagne flute as if giving a toast. "We have your prints, too, if needed." She turned and raised a toast to one of the cameras. "No," Aparicio said. "Yes," Lorna said. "We'll see you in court," Jennifer said. The women headed to the side door of the gallery, where a Lincoln driven by Cisco was waiting. Their job was done. That was then. This was now. I sat in the Honorable Coleman Perry's courtroom, preparing to defend the service and validity of the Aparicio subpoena and the very heart of the defense's case. My co-counsel, Jennifer Aronson, sat next to me at the defense table, and next to her was our client, Lisa Trammell. At the opposing table sat Louis Aparicio and his 2 attorneys, Martin Zimmer and Landon Cross. Andrea Freeman was in a seat located back against the rail. As the prosecutor of the criminal case out of which this hearing arose, she was an interested party, but this wasn't her cause of action. Additionally, Detective Curlin was in the courtroom, sitting 3 rows back in the gallery. His presence was a mystery to me. The cause of action was Aparicio's. He and his legal crew were out to quash the subpoena and prevent his participation in the trial. In strategizing how to do so, they had thought it prudent to tip Freeman to the hearing, in case the prosecution also saw merit in keeping Aparicio from the jury. Though largely there as a bystander, Freeman could step into the fray whenever she wanted, and she knew that whether she joined in or not, the hearing would likely offer her a good look at the defense's trial strategy. It was the first time I saw Aparicio in person. He was a block of a man, who somehow appeared as wide as he was tall. The skin on his face had been stretched tight by the scalpel or by years of anger. By the cut of his hair and of his suit, he looked like money. And he seemed to me to be the perfect straw man, because he also looked like a man who could kill, or at least give the order to kill. Aparicio's lawyers had asked the judge to hold the hearing in camera, behind closed doors in his chambers, so that the details revealed would not reach the media and therefore possibly taint the jury pool that would assemble the following day. But everybody in the room knew that his lawyers were not being altruistic. A closed hearing guarded against details about Aparicio leaking to the press and informing something much larger than the jury pool. Public opinion. I argued vigorously against closing the proceedings. I warned that such a move would cause public suspicion about the subsequent trial, and this outweighed any possible taint of the jury pool. Elected to the bench, Perry was ever mindful of public perception. He agreed with me and declared the hearing open to the public. Score a big one for me. My prevailing on that one argument probably saved the entire case for the defense. Not a lot of the media was there, but there was enough for what I needed. Reporters from the Los Angeles Business Journal and the LA Times were in the front row. A freelance video man who sold footage to all the networks was in the empty jury box with his camera. I had tipped him to the hearing and told him to be there. I figured that between the print media and the lone TV camera, there would be enough pressure on Aparicio to force the outcome I was looking for. After dispensing with the request to hide behind closed doors, the judge got down to business.
Mr. Zimmer, you have filed a motion to quash the subpoena of Louis Aparicio in the matter of California versus Trammell. Why don't you state your case, sir?
Zimmer looked like a lawyer who had been around the block a few times, and usually got to carry his enemies home in his briefcase. He stood to respond to the judge.
We would love to address the court on this matter, Your Honor. I'm going to speak first to the facts of the service of the subpoena itself, and then my colleague, Mr. Cross, will discuss the other issue for which we seek relief.
Zimmer then proceeded to claim that my office had engaged in mail fraud in laying the trap that resulted in Aparicio being served a subpoena. He said that the glossy brochure that had baited his client was an instrument of fraud, and its placement in the U.S. mail constituted a felony that invalidated any action that followed, such as service of the subpoena. He further asked that the defense be penalized by being disallowed from any subsequent effort to subpoena Aparicio to testify. I didn't even have to stand up for this one, which was a good thing, because the simple acts of standing and sitting still set off flares of pain across my chest. The judge raised his hand in my direction to hold me in check, and then tersely dismissed Zimmer's argument, calling it novel, but ridiculous and without merit.
Come on, Mr. Zimmer. This is the big league, Perry said. You have anything with some meat on the bone?
Properly cowed, Zimmer deferred to his colleague and sat down. Landon Cross stood up next to face the judge.
Your Honor, he said, Louis Aparicio is a man of means and standing in this community. He has had nothing to do with this crime or this trial and objects to his name and reputation being sullied by his inclusion in it. Let me emphatically repeat, he had nothing to do with this crime. Is not a suspect, and has no knowledge of it. He has no probative or exculpatory information to provide. He objects to defense counsel's putting him on the witness stand to conduct a fishing expedition, and he objects to counsel's using him as a deflection from the case at hand. Let Mr. Haller fish for red herrings in a different pond.
Cross turned and gestured to Andrea Freeman.
I might add, Your Honor, that the prosecution joins me in this motion to quash for the same reasons mentioned.
The judge swiveled on his seat and looked at me.
Mr. Haller, you want to respond to all of that?
I stood up, slowly. I was holding the foam gavel from my desk, working it with my fingers, which were newly freed from plaster, but still stiff.
Yes, Your Honor. I would first like to say that Mr. Cross makes a good point about the fishing expedition. Mr. Aparicio's testimony at trial, if allowed to proceed, would include a fair amount of fishing. Not all of it, mind you, but I would like to drop a line in the water. But this is only, Your Honor, because Mr. Aparicio and his defensive front have made it darn near impossible for the defense to conduct a thorough investigation of the murder of Mitchell Bondurant. Mr. Aparicio and his henchmen have thwarted all... Zimmer was up on his feet objecting loudly.
Your Honor, I mean really, henchmen? Counsel is clearly engaged in playing to the media in the courtroom at Mr. Aparizio's expense. I once again urge you to move these proceedings to chambers before we continue.
We're staying put, Perry said. But Mr. Holler, I'm not going to allow you to call this witness just to let you grandstand for the jury. What's his connection? What's he got?
I nodded like I was ready with an obvious answer.
Mr. Aparizio founded and operates a company that acts as a middleman in the foreclosure process. When the victim in this case decided to foreclose on the home of the defendant, he went to Mr. Aparizio to get it done. That, to me, Your Honor, puts Mr. Aparizio on the front line of this case, and I would like to ask him about this, because the prosecution has stated to the media that the foreclosure is the motive for the murder.
Zimmer jumped in before the judge could respond.
That is a ridiculous assertion. Mr. Aparizio's company has 185 employees. It is housed in a three-level office building. Foreclosing on people's homes is big business, I interjected.
Counsel, the judge warned.
Mr. Aparizio had nothing whatsoever to do with the defendant's foreclosure other than the fact that it was handled by his company, along with about 100,000 other such cases this year, Zimmer said.
100,000 cases, Mr. Zimmer? The judge asked.
That's right, Judge. On average, the company has been handling 2,000 foreclosures a week for more than 2 years. This would include the defendant's foreclosure case. Mr. Aparizio has no specific knowledge of her case. It was one of many and was never on his radar.
The judge dropped deep into thought and looked like he had heard enough. I had hoped not to have to reveal my ace in the hole, especially in front of the prosecutor. But I had to assume Freeman was already aware of the Bondurant letter and its value. I reached down to the file in front of me on the table and flipped it open. There were the letter and four copies, ready to go.
Mr. Holler, I'm inclined to, Your Honor, if the court would indulge me. I would like to be allowed to ask Mr. Aparizio the name of his personal secretary.
That gave Perry another pause, and he screwed his mouth up in confusion.
You want to know who his secretary is?
His personal secretary, yes.
Why would you want to know that, sir?
I'm asking the court to indulge me.
Very well, Mr. Aparizio. Mr. Holler would like the name of your personal secretary.
Aparizio leaned forward and looked at Zimmer as if needing his approval. Zimmer signaled him to go on and answer the question.
Judge, I actually have two. One is Carmen Esposito, and the other is Natalie Lazara.
He then leaned back. The judge looked at me. It was time to play the ace. Judge, I have here copies of a certified letter that was written by Mitchell Bondurant, the murder victim, and sent to Mr. Aparizio. It was received and signed for by his personal secretary, Natalie Lazara. The letter was turned over to me in discovery by the prosecution. I would like Mr. Aparizio to testify in court so that I can question him about it.
Let's take a look, Perry said.
I stepped away from the table and delivered copies of the letter to the judge and then to Zimmer. On my way back, I swung by Freeman and offered her a copy.
No thanks, I already have it.
I nodded and went back to the table, but stayed standing.
Your Honor, Zimmer said, can we have a short recess to look this over? We haven't seen it before.
15 minutes, Perry said.
The judge stepped down from the bench and went through the door to his chambers. I waited to see if the Aparizio team would take it out into the hall. When they didn't move, I didn't. I wanted them to worry that I might overhear something. I huddled with Aronson and Trammell.
What are they doing? Aronson whispered. They had to have known about the letter already.
I'm sure the prosecution gave them a copy, I said. Aparizio acts like he's the smartest guy in the room. Now we're going to see if he is the smartest guy in the room.
What do you mean?
We've got him between a rock and a hard place. He knows he should tell the judge that if I ask about the letter, he will take the fifth and therefore the subpoena should be kicked. But he knows if he takes the fifth in front of the media here, he's in trouble. That puts blood in the water.
So what do you think he'll do?
Trammell asked. Act like the smartest guy. I pushed back from the table and stood up. I nonchalantly started to pace behind the tables. Zimmer looked over his shoulder at me and then leaned in closer to his client. Eventually, I came back to Freeman, still in her chair. When do you wait in?
Oh, I'm thinking I might not have to.
They already had the letter, didn't they? You gave it to them. She shrugged her shoulders but didn't answer. I looked past her to Curlin sitting three rows back. What's Curlin doing here?
Oh, he might be needed.
That was a lot of help. Last week when you made the offer, that was because you had found the letter, wasn't it? You thought your case was in real trouble. She looked up at me and smiled, not giving anything away. What changed? Why'd you pull the offer back? Again, she didn't answer. You think he's going to take the fifth, don't you? The shrug again. I would, I said. But him? We'll know soon enough, she said dismissively. I went back to the table and sat down. Trammell whispered to me that she still wasn't clear on what was going on. We want Aparicio to testify at trial. He doesn't want to, but the only way the judge will let him out of the subpoena is if he says he'll invoke his Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. If he does that, we're dead. He's our straw man. We need to get him on the stand.
Do you think he will take the fifth?
I'm betting no. Too much at stake with the media here. He's putting the finishing touches on a big merger, and knows if he takes the nickel, the media will be all over him. I think he's just smart enough to think he can talk his way out of it on the stand. That's what I'm counting on. Him thinking he's smarter than everybody else.
What if...
She was cut off by the return of the judge to the bench. He quickly went back on record, and Zimmer asked to address the court.
Your Honor, I would like the record to reflect that against the advice of counsel, my client has instructed me to withdraw the motion to quash.
The judge nodded and pursed his lips. He looked at Aparicio.
So your client will testify in front of the jury? He asked.
Yes, Your Honor, Zimmer said. He has made that decision.
You sure about this, Mr. Aparicio? You have a lot of experience sitting with you at that table.
Yes, Your Honor, Aparicio said. I'm sure.
Then motion withdrawn. Any other business before the court before we begin jury selection tomorrow morning?
Perry looked past the tables to Freeman. It was a tell. He knew there was further business to discuss. Freeman stood up, file in hand.
Yes, Your Honor, may I approach?
Please do, Miss Freeman.
Freeman stepped forward, but then waited for the Aparicio team to finish packing and move off the prosecution's table. The judge waited patiently. Finally, she took her place at the table, remaining standing.
Let me guess, Perry said. You want to talk about Mr. Haller's updated witness list?
Yes, Judge, I do. I also have an evidentiary issue to bring up. Which would you like to hear first?
Evidentiary issue. I suddenly knew why Curlin was in the courtroom.
Let's go with the witness list first, the judge said. I saw that one coming.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Haller has put his co-counsel down on the witness list, and I think, first of all, he needs to choose between having Ms. Aronson as second chair and having her as a witness. But second, and more important, Ms. Aronson has already handled the preliminary hearing for the defense as well as other duties. And so, the state objects to this sudden move to make her a witness in the trial.
Freeman sat down, and the judge looked over at me.
Sort of late in the game, isn't it, Mr. Haller?
I stood.
Yes, Your Honor. Except for the fact that it is no game, and it's my client's freedom at stake here.
The defense would ask the court for wide latitude in this regard. Miss Aronson was intimately involved in the defense against the foreclosure proceedings against my client, and the defense has come to the conclusion that she will be needed to explain to jurors what the background was and what was happening at the time of the murder of Mr. Bondurant.
And it is your plan to have her do double duty, both witness and defense counsel? That's not going to happen in my courtroom, sir.
Your Honor, I assume when I put Ms. Aronson's name on the final list that we would have this discussion with Ms. Freeman. The defense is open to the court's decision in regard to this. Perry looked at Freeman to see if she had further argument. She held still.
Very well, then, he said. You just lost your second chair, Mr. Haller.
I will allow Ms. Aronson to remain on the witness list, but tomorrow, when we start picking the jury, you're on your own. Ms. Aronson stays clear of my courtroom until she comes in to testify.
Thank you, Your Honor, I said. Will she be able to join me as second chair after her testimony is concluded?
I don't see that as a problem. Ms. Freeman, you had a second issue for the court?
Freeman stood back up. I sat down and leaned forward with my pen ready to take notes. The movement caused a searing pain to cross my torso, and I almost groaned out loud.
Your Honor, the state wants to head off an objection and protest I am sure will come from counsel. Late yesterday, we received a return on DNA analysis of a very small blood trace found on a shoe belonging to the defendant and seized during the search of her house and garage on the day of the murder.
I felt an invisible punch in my stomach that made my rib pain disappear quickly. I instinctively knew this was going to be a game changer.
The analysis matches the blood from the shoe to the victim, Mitchell Bondurant. Before counsel protests, I must inform the court that analysis of the blood was delayed because of the backup in the lab and because the sample being worked with was rather minute. The difficulty was accentuated by the need to preserve a portion of the sample for the defense.
I flipped my pen up into the air. It bounced onto the table and then clattered to the floor. I stood up. Your Honor, this is just outrageous. On the eve of jury selection? To pull this now? And boy, oh boy, that sure was nice of them to leave some for the defense. We'll just run out and get it analyzed before jury selection starts tomorrow. You know, this is just...
Point well taken, counsel, the judge interrupted. It troubles me as well, Ms. Freeman. You've had this evidence since the inception of the case. How can it be that it conveniently lands the day before jury selection?
Your Honor, Freeman said, I have a full understanding of the burden this places on the defense and the court. But it is what it is. I was informed of the findings at 8 o'clock this morning when I received the report from the lab. This is the first opportunity I've had to bring it before the court. As to the reason for its coming in now, well, there are a few. I am sure the court is aware of the backup for DNA analysis at the lab at Cal State. There are thousands of cases. While homicide investigations certainly get a priority, it is not to the exclusion of all other cases. We elected not to go to a private lab that could have turned it around faster because of the concern over the size of the sample. We knew if anything went wrong with an outside vendor, then we would have completely lost the opportunity to test the blood and hold a portion for the defense.
I shook my head in frustration while waiting for the chance to speak again. This was indeed a game changer. It had been a completely circumstantial case. Now, it was a case involving direct evidence connecting the defendant to the crime.
Mr. Holler, the judge said, you want to respond?
I sure do, Judge. I think this goes beyond being sandbagged, and I don't for a moment believe the timing here is happenstance. I would ask that the court tell the prosecution that it is too late to spring this now. I move that this so-called evidence be excluded from the trial.
What about delaying the trial? The judge said. What if you were given the time to get the analysis done and get up to speed on this?
Get up to speed? Judge, this isn't just about getting our own analysis done. This is about changing the entire defense strategy. The prosecution is seeking to change this from a circumstantial case to a science-based case on the eve of trial. I don't only need time to do DNA testing. After 2 months, I now need to rethink the entire case. This is devastating. Your Honor, it should not be allowed under the basic idea of fair play.
Freeman wanted a comeback, but the judge didn't allow it. I took that as a good sign, until I saw him looking at the calendar, hanging on the wall behind the clerk's corral. That told me he was only willing to ameliorate the situation with time. He was going to allow the DNA into evidence, and would just give me extra time to prepare for it.
I sat back down in defeat. Lisa Trammell leaned toward me and desperately whispered,
Mickey, this can't be. It's a setup. There's no way his blood could be on those shoes. You have to believe me.
I put my hand up to cut her off. I didn't have to believe a word out of her mouth, and that was all beside the point. The reality was that the case was shifting. No wonder Freeman had all her confidence back. Suddenly I realized something. I quickly stood back up. Too quickly. Pain shot down my torso into my groin, and I bent over the defense table.
Your Honor?
Are you all right, Mr. Holler? I slowly straightened up. Yes, Your Honor. But I need to add something to the record, if I may.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, the defense questions the veracity of the prosecution's claim of learning only about this DNA result this morning. 3 weeks ago, Ms. Freeman offered my client a very attractive disposition, giving Ms. Trammell 24 hours to think it over. Then,
Your Honor, Freeman said.
Don't interrupt, the judge commanded. Continue, Mr. Holler. I had no qualms about breaking my agreement with Freeman not to reveal the disposition negotiations. The gloves were off at this point. Thank you, Your Honor. So we get an offer on a Thursday night, and then on Friday morning, Miss Freeman mysteriously yanks it right back off the table without explanation. Well, I think we now have that explanation, Judge. She knew back then, 3 weeks ago, about this supposed DNA evidence but decided to sit on it in order to surprise the defense with it on the eve of trial. And I thank you, Mr. Holler.
What about that, Ms. Freeman?
I could see the skin around the judge's eyes had drawn tight. He was upset. What I had just revealed had the ring of truth to it.
Your Honor, Freeman said indignantly, nothing could be further from the truth. I have with me in the gallery here Detective Curlin, who will be happy to testify under oath that the DNA report was delivered over the weekend to his office and opened by him shortly after his arrival at 7:30 this morning. He then called me, and I brought it to court. The district attorney's office has not sat on anything, and I resent the aspersion directed at me personally by counsel.
The judge glanced out to the rows of seats and spotted Curlin, then looked back at Freeman. Why did you withdraw the offer a day after making it? He asked. The million-dollar question. Freeman seemed unsettled that the judge would carry the inquiry any further.
Judge, that decision involved internal issues perhaps better not aired in court.
I want to understand this, counsel. If you want this evidence, then you better allay my concerns, internal issues or not.
Freeman nodded.
Yes, Your Honor. As you know, there is an interim district attorney since Mr. Williams joined the U.S. Attorney General's office in Washington. This has resulted in a situation where we don't always have clear lines of communication and direction. Suffice to say that on that Thursday, I had a supervisor's approval for the offer I made to Mr. Holler. But on Friday morning, I learned from a higher authority in the office that the offer was not approved internally, and so I withdrew it.
It was a load of crap, but she had delivered it well, and I had nothing that contradicted it. But when she told me the offer was gone that Friday, I knew by the tone of her voice that she had something new, something else. And her decision had nothing to do with internal communication and direction. The judge made his ruling.
I'm going to put back jury selection 10 court days. This should give the defense time to have DNA testing of the evidence completed if it chooses to do so. It also allows ample time to consider what strategic change will come with this information. I will hold the state responsible for being totally cooperative in this matter and in getting the biological material to the defense without delay. All parties will be prepared to begin jury selection 2 weeks from today. Court is adjourned.
The judge quickly left the bench. I looked down at the empty page on my legal pad. I had just been eviscerated. Slowly, I started packing my briefcase.
What do we do? Aronson asked.
I don't know yet, I said.
Run the test, Lisa Trammell said urgently. They've got it wrong. It can't be his blood on my shoes. This is unreal.
I looked at her, her brown eyes fervent and believable. Don't worry, I'll figure something out. The optimism tasted sour in my mouth. I glanced over at Freeman.
She was looking through files in her briefcase. I sauntered over, and she gave me a dismissive look. She wasn't interested in hearing my tale of woe. "You look like things just went exactly the way you wanted them to go," I said. She showed nothing. She closed her case and headed toward the gate. Before pushing through, she looked back at me.
"You want to play hardball, Holler?" she said.
"Then you have to be ready to catch." Chapter 19. The next 2 weeks went by quickly, but not without progress. The defense rethought and retooled. I had an independent lab confirm the state's DNA findings at a rush cost of $4,000, and then assimilated the devastating evidence into a view of the case that allowed for the science to be correct, as well as my client's innocence to be possible, if not probable. The classic set-up defense. It would be an additional and natural dimension to the straw man gambit. I began to believe it could work, and my confidence began to rebuild. By the time delayed jury selection finally started, I had some momentum going and rolled it into the effort, actively looking for the jurors who might lend themselves to believing the new story I was going to spin for them. It wasn't until the fourth day of jury selection that yet one more Freeman fastball came whistling at my head. We were nearing completion of the panel, and it was one of those rare times when both prosecution and defense were happy with the jury's makeup, but for different reasons. The panel was well-stocked with working-class men and women, homeowners who came from two-income households. Few had college diplomas, and none had advanced degrees. Real salt-of-the-earth people, and this was a perfect composition for me. I was going for people who lived close to the edge in the tough economy, who felt the threat of foreclosure at all times, and would have a hard time looking at a banker as a sympathetic victim. On the other hand, the prosecution asked detailed financial questions of each prospective juror, and was looking for hard workers who wouldn't see someone who stopped paying her mortgage as a victim either. The result, until the morning of the fourth day, was a panel full of jurors neither side objected to, and who we each thought we could mold into our own soldiers of justice. The fastball came when Judge Perry called for the mid-morning break. Freeman immediately stood up and asked the judge if counsel could meet in chambers during the break to discuss an evidentiary issue that had just come up. She asked if Detective Curlin could join the meeting. Perry granted the request and doubled the break time to a half hour. I then followed Freeman, who followed the court reporter and the judge into chambers. Curlin came in last, and I noticed he was carrying a large manila envelope with red evidence tape on it. It was bulky and appeared to have something heavy inside. The paper envelope was the real giveaway, though. Biological evidence was always wrapped in paper. Plastic evidence bags trapped air and humidity and could damage biologicals. So I knew going in, Freeman was about to drop another DNA bomb on me. "Here we go again," I said under my breath as I entered the chambers. The judge moved behind his desk and sat down, his back to a window that looked south toward the hills over Sherman Oaks. Freeman and I took side-by-side seats opposite the desk. Curlin pulled a chair over from a nearby table, and the court reporter sat on a stool to the judge's right. Her steno machine was on a tripod in front of her. "We're on the record here," the judge said. "Miss Freeman?" "Judge, I wanted to meet with you and counsel for the defense as soon as possible, because I am anticipating that once again Mr. Holler will howl at the moon when he hears what I have to say, and what I have to show." "Then let's get on with it," Perry said. Freeman nodded to Curlin, and he started peeling back the tape on the evidence envelope. I said nothing. I noticed that he had a rubber glove on his right hand. "The prosecution has come into possession of the murder weapon," Freeman stated matter-of-factly, "and plans to introduce it as evidence, as well as make it available to the defense for examination." Curlin opened the envelope, reached in, and brought out a hammer. It was a claw hammer, with a brushed steel head and a circular striking surface. It had a polished redwood handle tipped in black rubber at the end.
I saw a notch at 12 o'clock on the strike face, and knew it likely corresponded with the skull impressions cataloged during the autopsy. I stood up angrily and walked away from the desk.
"Oh, come on," I said in full outrage. "Are you kidding me?"
I looked at the wall of shelved codebooks Perry had at the far side of the room, put my hands on my hips in indignation, and then turned back to the desk.
"Judge, excuse my language, but this is bullshit. She can't do this again. To spring this, what, 4 days into jury selection, and a day before opening statements? We have most of the box already picked. We are possibly going to start tomorrow, and she's suddenly laying the supposed murder weapon on me?"
The judge leaned back in his seat, as if distancing himself from the hammer Curlin was holding.
"You better have a good and convincing story, Ms. Freeman," he said.
"I do, Judge. I could not bring this forward until this morning, and I am more than willing to explain why if..."
"You allowed this," I said, interrupting and pointing a finger at the judge.
"Excuse me, Mr. Holler, but don't you dare point your finger at me," he said with restraint.
"I'm sorry, Judge, but this is your fault. You let her get away with the bullshit DNA story, and after that, there's no reason for her not to..."
"Excuse me, sir, but you had better proceed cautiously. You are about 5 seconds away from seeing the inside of my holding cell. You do not point your finger or address a Superior Court judge as you have. Do you understand me?"
I turned back to the code books and took a deep breath. I knew I had to get something out of this. I had to come out of this room with the judge owing me something. "I understand," I finally said.
"Good," Perry said. "Now come back over here and take a seat. Let's hear what Miss Freeman and Detective Curlin have to say, and it better be good."
Reluctantly, I returned like a chastised child and dropped into my seat.
"Miss Freeman, let's hear it."
"Yes, Your Honor. The weapon was turned in to us late Monday afternoon. A land..."
"Great," I said. "I knew it. So you wait until 4 days into jury selection before you decide to..."
"Mr. Holler," the judge barked. "I have lost all patience with you. Do not interrupt again. Continue, Ms. Freeman, please."
"Of course, Your Honor. As I said, we received this at the LAPD's Van Nuys division late Monday afternoon. I think it would be best if Detective Curlin runs you through the chain of custody."
Perry gestured to the detective to begin.
"What happened was that a landscaper working in a yard on Dickens Street near Kester Avenue found it that morning, lodged in a hedge near the front of his client's house. This is in the street that runs behind Westland National. The house is approximately 2 blocks from the rear of the bank. The landscaper who found the hammer is from Gardenia, and had no idea about the murder. But thinking the tool belonged to his client, he left it on the porch for him. The homeowner, a man named Donald Myers, didn't see it until he came home from work about 5 o'clock that afternoon. He was confused because he knew it was not his hammer. However, he then remembered reading articles about the Bondurant murder, at least one of which indicated the murder weapon might be a hammer, and that it had not been found yet. He called his landscaper and got his story, then he called the police."
"Well, you've told us how you got it," Perry said. "You haven't explained why we're hearing about it 3 days later."
Freeman nodded. She was ready for this and took over the narrative.
"Judge, we obviously had to confirm what we had and the chain of custody. We immediately turned it over to the Scientific Investigation Division for processing, and only received the lab reports yesterday evening after court."
"And what do those reports conclude?"
"The only fingerprints on the weapon belong to..."
"Wait a minute," I said, risking the judge's ire again. "Can we just refer to it as the hammer? Calling it the weapon on the record is a bit presumptuous at this point."
"Fine," Freeman said before the judge could respond. "The hammer. The only fingerprints on the hammer belong to Mr. Myers and his landscaper, Antonio Ladera. However, two things tie it solidly into the case. A small spot of blood found on the neck of the hammer has been conclusively matched through DNA testing to Mitchell Bondurant.
We rushed this test with an outside vendor because of the protest council made over the precautions taken with the other test. The hammer was also turned over to the medical examiner's office for comparison to the wound patterns on the victim.